welcome listeners and Patreon subscribers to the 9-8 podcast, the home of everything progressive and underground right here in Australia. My name is David Ellis, and as always, every fortnight I am joined by the wonderful man from the Western Coast, Mr. Alex Hogg. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
Good. Still obviously well in lockdown and all that kind of stuff that's going on in Australia at the moment because, you know, kind of everything is just kind of fucked at the moment, thanks to viruses and things. But otherwise, we're doing okay. You guys have had your own little problems over there in Western Australia with certain people trying to challenge state rules and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. There's a whole world of stuff that can be discussed there, all of which we're going to ignore today because if I, as a homegrown, born in WA man, if I start yelling about Clive Palmer, there will be no end to the yelling.
Oh, absolutely.
So I'm just going to skip past all of that.
Yep, absolutely.
And jump straight into follow-up. Now,
absolutely.
You've got a bit of follow-up in here, Dave, about Russia's, I'm going to use the word alleged COVID vaccine because depending on who you listen to and depending on who you talk to, depends on whether or not it works. But you've got something in here, Dave. What's this about?
Yeah, I was having a think about it. And we've been talking over the last few episodes about, you know, video games and how things tie in with video games and all that. And it's kind of just occurred to me that 2020 is kind of like a massive, really weird, fucked up video game, like something a la Bioshock or something like that. And at the moment, Russia has a vaccine. They're saying they have a vaccine for COVID. And it's bringing me back to a game from the mid-2000s called Resistance Fall of Man. Now, if anyone here has played that game, you know it was a PlayStation exclusive. I'm pretty sure it was on the PS3. And basically what happens is there's a whole bunch of creatures that come out from behind the Iron Curtain in Russia, and the US kind of wants to be isolationist and so on and so forth. But I kind of have to wonder whether or not this COVID vaccine is going to turn everyone into chimeras or, you know, zombies or something like that, like
I was having this conversation at work with some colleagues of ours, of mine, and the general pervading theory was that maybe this is like the boot starting of like Zombieland or iRobot. Is it iRobot? The one with Will Smith where he's in
That's iRobot. Yep.
Yeah, iRobot, that one.
Where every single car is a Lexus.
Something like that. Yeah, exactly. and everything's a Mac.
Yeah. But hey, you know what? If the vaccine works and it's effective and all that sort of stuff, then hey, you know, maybe this time in a month's time, we'll be back to live music and all that sort of stuff, and everything will just take off again.
I doubt very much that will take a month. I think it'll probably take a month just to produce enough vaccines to get everything out to everybody.
Maybe.
And they better. Yeah, I think so. It'll take a month. Think about it. We're going to have to produce billions, literally billions of these.
Yeah, I know.
It's not going to be quick.
I don't know. I don't know how long it takes to produce one. I don't know, but I'm just saying, you know, maybe a month, maybe 2 months, who knows? Maybe everything is going to go back to normal. We will see. Another piece of follow-up I did want to drop in here as well is, as the heads of the Dream Theater Fan Club of Australia and New Zealand, we have been bombarded with emails from people asking us, hey, what's happening with the tour in November? And, you know, are my tickets still valid? And, you know, have I wasted my money and all this sort of stuff? I just want to jump on here and take this opportunity to say, we don't know. We know as much as you guys know at this point. And if we know anything, we learn anything, we can share anything, we will let you know. But as it stands at the moment, it's kind of been radio silence from numerous different camps. And we have been emailing, we have been trying to get onto some people, some of the guys over in the States, you know, et cetera, and the guys here as well. So once we know something, we will let you know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, because of the nature of this tour, you know, the Australian leg of it is in the middle of an Asian tour, and there are lots of the situation in the wider Asia Pacific region ranges all the way from areas that are basically more or less back to quote unquote normal, all the way through to Victoria, which as of this recording is still in lockdown,
stage 4 lockdown.
Yes, stage 4 lockdown. They can't go anywhere. Only allowed to go to the shops once a day. Can't be seen more than 5 kilometres from the house. Got to wear a mask at all times. So that's the gamut of things that are just so the very local problems that the promoters have to deal with are so widely disparate. They can't possibly make a decision, and that decision that would be made would be changing from time to time. So,
yeah.
I'm not particularly surprised that there is no official word as yet, because it's such an ever-changing, fluid situation. You know, who knows what can happen, you know, over the coming months. But rest assured, if there's something to tell, you know, you'll hear it here first, and you'll hear about it on the Australian Dream Theatre Fan Club Facebook page.
Mm, absolutely. Now, you've got something on here as well, Bruce Dickinson's autobiography.
Is an autobiography that I've been listening to via audiobook over the last couple of weeks. And in that, he had a whole chapter about how he has to deal with his voice when he's on the road, and talking about very specific things that he does, exercises to do with the diaphragm, foods to avoid, you know, the whole backstage area has to be like smoke free and all these sorts of things. And it got me thinking about that what he does and what James LaBrie did, and how he explained it to me in the interview that we did with him last year. So if you haven't heard Bruce Dickinson's autobiography, it's an excellent autobiography. He's reading it himself, so that's the version that I'm listening to. Have a listen. So when you get to that chapter, if you're reading it or listening to it, there's a bit more information that from our interview with James LaBrie. So I just wanted to draw a link between those two things here.
Absolutely. But I think that's about it for follow-up. I think we should jump into the news.
And, well, the biggest piece of news that we have to talk about is, after much publicity and much sort of mutterings and chattings, finally the lead-off single from John Petrucci's solo album, Terminal Velocity, is available to watch on YouTube. What did you think about this one, Dave?
Can I pass?
No, you can't pass.
I don't know. I thought it was a bit safe and a bit straight for my liking. It didn't have that. If you go back to his original solo album, it was really, really, really interesting because of the stuff he was doing at that time and the complexity that he was playing with on that album kind of matched the complexity that he was doing in Dream Theater and so on and so forth. This one kind of seems like a bit of a hark back to the original solo album. So it's a little bit straighter, it's a little bit more simple, but it is only the lead single. And if we know anything about John and the way that he releases lead singles and such off albums as they had with Dream Theater, it very well may be the weakest track on the album. And I'm kind of hoping
to say basically exactly the same thing. Like, I have a theory about why this particular song is the lead-off single. You are right. It is pretty much what you would expect from a John Petrucci solo song. Like, you know, it's a very interesting guitar melody, and then it's all the usual, I'm going to call them iconic John Petrucci moments, where, you know, he's doing a fast run and there's like a tom thing keeping the beat. That's in there. All these sorts of things. But what I think is I'm thinking about this song in the same way as On the Backs of Angels.
Mm-hmm.
When, you know, after all that, you know, this is the first solo album he's released. This is the, you know, his second solo album. The last one was 15 years ago. So what do we put out as the lead single? We put out the safe one, the one that makes people think, right, okay, we know what we're getting with this.
Yeah.
Same story with On the Backs of Angels. First record they did without Mike Portnoy, and so they did the safe one. So I think it's very much the same. Also, in the film clip, can we just stop for a second and talk about Baby Yoda?
I did notice that Baby Yoda was in that.
Look, you know, I'm hesitant to say this because I don't want to open a Pandora's box here for you, Dave, are you familiar with the concept of Baby Yoda cringe posting?
No, I'm not, though I have a sneaking suspicion I'm about to be because...
Yes, I've just sent you some pictures from a Baby Yoda cringe posting group. What do you think about these?
What the Jesus fuck?
Yes. This is a thing. Now, I don't know how I'm going to be able to post these onto the internet for people in the show notes, for people to watch this. I don't even know if I want to post this on the internet for people.
This is just weird.
Yes, it is. Unfortunately for me, and thanks goes to my wife for this, every time I see a baby Yoda, I think about crap like this.
Well, now I will.
I would like to believe. Yes, like I said, this is like things that are seen that now cannot be unseen.
Indeed.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
I would like to think that John Petrucci doesn't think about his baby Yoda in this way, because, oh man, that would like break many Dream Theater people's brains over that one.
Including mine. I don't think he does. I know John's a bit of a nerd, so he likes Star Wars and all that kind of stuff. So.
Look, there's Star Wars nerdery and there's whatever the hell this is. Well,
same thing with anime, right? There's anime, there's people who like anime, and then there's waifus. So,
yes,
you know.
Yep.
I'd imagine it's sort of a similar thing. But, oh, man. Okay, we're moving on from that because I can't stand the thought of John doing that kind of stuff. Oh, God. Yes. Maybe I will ask him.
That's all you, mate. You can have that one.
I will do, which is probably a good point to and put that in here, actually. John will be joining me on the show in the next couple of weeks sometime, and I'll be doing an interview with him. So maybe I'll ask him about that on there. I don't know. But if you guys have got any questions that you want to have asked, then by all means, send them in. Tweet at us or jump to us on a forum or something like that on Facebook, and we'll see what we can do.
Anyway, moving right along, we have the title track from Pain of Salvation, Panther, that is available on the video, is available on YouTube to watch now. What did you think about this one, Dave?
I suspect angry emails are going to come from this episode. Limp Bizkit wants their sound back, guys. I just can't.
Yeah,
know.
There's like a bit of a Limp Bizkit, a bit of a Nine Inch Nails kind of thing going on there.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It didn't really do much for me, to be really honest with you. Yes, it's very cool, but I'm kind of worried at how different it is from the first single. You know,
yes.
I mean? Like it doesn't seem
and
like
even,
there's going
to
be.
And even from the second one as well, which we'll get to that in a minute.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like there's going to be cohesion in the album, almost like sort of like a collection of ideas and threads rather than, you know, an idea that sort of all comes together. So I'm a bit concerned about that. The song itself didn't really do much for me, but that doesn't necessarily make it a bad song. It just means that I didn't like it.
That'll be a theme for it going through this episode, but we'll get to we'll
there's
get
the episode
to that
title.
Yes, indeed. We'll get to that in a moment. But moving on, we have Jacko Jacksick has released a new solo record. Is releasing a new solo record, Secrets and Lies. That will be out October the 23rd. Mm-hmm. The lead-off single, The Trouble with Angels, has been released, and there is a rather excellent video on YouTube at the moment where you can go and have a watch of that. What did you think of this song, Dave?
I actually haven't seen it yet. I have been too absorbed in my own stuff over the last little while, and I'm sort of, there's some things that have been slipping through the cracks, unfortunately, and this is one of them. But Jacko Jacksick is probably more up your alley, I would imagine, anyway. So why don't you tell us about it?
Very much so. I mean, this song is very melancholic. He has a beautiful voice. I don't know why, but Jacko seems to get a whack from many King Crimson fans who don't think he can sing or hold him in comparison to his predecessors, Greg Lake, John Wetton, Adrian Belew, all titans in prog rock. I don't know why. I personally think he's a very good singer and does a very good job with pre-existing King Crimson material. Mm-hmm. But this song is definitely in a slightly different place to those sorts of songs, but it's a beautiful, beautiful song, very melancholic. And with a rhythm section of Tony Levin and Gavin Harrison, how can you go wrong?
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, that's a pretty amazing.
Some of the songs on this album apparently come from some of King Crimson's writing sessions. That's what's been quoted in the release, which is very interesting because there are conflicting reports about whether or not there ever will be a new King Crimson record.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there will be, personally, but who knows with King Crimson these days.
Yeah, well, they can be a little bit... they're a bit of an enigma, aren't they?
Yes. I mean, they have new songs that get performed from time to time live. And I think that, like, especially the way the music business is going, I mean, you think about it this way. You've got to convene the band, get them together to record, to do sessions to record an album, and then the way the music market is, you're effectively press-ganged into giving the record away? Mm. Why would you do it?
Yeah, exactly.
In their position, why would you do it? Fuck it. Just keep playing the songs live. Maybe they'll see the light of day on a live release at some point. In fact, I'm fairly certain one or two of them already have. And then you just do it that way. Why bother going through the hassle of having to try and record a record?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
There's that. I think this song is beautiful. Beautiful, beautiful song. Everybody should go and have a listen to it. If you like the song, you should pre-order the record as well. We can put a link in the show notes to where you can pre-order that. Now, speaking of pre-orders, Life Signs are starting up a crowdfunding campaign for their forthcoming record, Altitude. Now, this record hasn't actually been recorded yet, but they've started the crowdfunding campaign. We'll put a link in the show notes to their website for all the different packages that can be put together.
Pretty sure these guys were one of the guys that got absolutely bent over with Pledge Music. Is that right?
Yeah, they did.
Yeah.
I mean, I have, well, yeah, the demise of Pledge Music and the scummy things they did with the money and basically traded insolvently, that's all one thing. The problem that I had with Pledge Music is even before all that went down, they fucked up Marillion's Pledge Music crowdfunding campaign in 2016.
Yeah.
The stuff was late, severely damaged, poorly packaged, it was just a mess to the point that Marillion there was some fairly strongly worded statements at the time about what they were going to do going forward. Had Pledge Music not fallen over and gone into bankruptcy, then Marillion were not going to use them for their next pledge, for their next crowdfunding campaign. They were going to take it all back in-house.
Mm-hmm.
But this idea, and so this is what Life Signs have done. They got burned badly with Pledge Music, and so they've decided to go it alone and run the crowdfunding themselves, which frankly I think is probably the way to do it anyway.
Yeah.
You retain control. You're not giving away your IP to anyone. You're dealing with your own distribution networks rather than relying on someone else's. So where is the downside, I think? The downside is getting enough people out there to actually buy the record, but yeah, that's the problem with it. That's a problem that everybody faces in this market.
Absolutely. It's probably the better way to go about it anyway.
I think so.
I agree with you, because you've got the ultimate control at the end of the day and the buck. People can come to you if there's a problem and you can get it sorted straight away instead of going through 55 different people. I think it's definitely the way to go.
So, changing gears slightly and bringing things back closer to home, there is a new single from a frequent contributor to the show and a band that we've spoken about before. The fellas from Sydney in Maiora, they have released a new single.
Yes,
the song
they
is
have.
Called Worlds Away. What did you think, Dave?
I quite enjoyed it. Instrumental prog is kind of, at the moment, seemingly dominated by that polyphia style of thing, which is, you know, really clean guitars and chimey and, you know, do-do-do-do-jing sort of stuff, you know.
Yep, I know what you mean.
These guys are not like that. So it was nice to hear some stuff coming through. I Built the Sky, actually.
I was going to say, somewhere between I Built the Sky and Pliny, I would say.
Yep, that's kind of totally
somewhere
fair.
Somewhere between those two. Not a criticism at all. It was a very, very talented guitar players. And, yes. We're going to sit down and have a chat with them in a couple of weeks' time. So we'll be asking a whole bunch of questions about how they approach their music, how they see the scene going, and all of that. So stay tuned for that one.
I do want to say as well that we actually reviewed some of their stuff previously on the show, and I said that it didn't – you could hear that it was quite young in its execution, I suppose. This is leaps and bounds ahead. Not only in the production and so on and so forth, but just in the phrasing and the way the track breathes and things like that, it is leaps and bounds ahead of their previous work. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, very much so. Two thumbs up from us. Go and check it out, people, and support these guys because they're doing some great stuff, and it's really nice to see young musicians coming through the scene and making an impression. It's good stuff.
Absolutely.
So the final piece of news that we have is that Jonas Reingold is putting together a little project in isolation. He's from Sweden, and he's putting together something called The Backstage, which is a little CD that a project recorded during the COVID-19 pandemic by Jonas Reingold, Craig Blundell, and Rob Townsend. So some big names of prog royalty, and they've put together a whole bunch of special guests, none of which are named at time of writing. But I'm going to read a quote here. It says, "If you are a fan of Return to Forever, the Mahavishnu Orchestra, Becca Brothers, and Billy Cobham, this CD is a must for you." So if that sort of jazz fusion style of music tickles your fancy, there is something for you to go and have a listen to when it comes out, and maybe even if you've got the means possible to support the pre-order that's happening.
So keeping things in Europe as well, sort of in Europe. They're kind of not, but they kind of are, and I don't know what's going on with that whole Brexit thing. But in England, they had the first socially distanced concert where basically you had almost like little pens set up and people were able to stand in the pens and watch the show at, you know, a safe distance away from each other. I think it was a maximum of 3 or 4 to a pen or something like that. It's not actually a pen. You need to see it. It's the easiest way to describe it. There's all jokes going around about sheeples and blah, 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 blah.
He did the artist, the headlined this particular show, an indie rocker named Sam Fender, made a joke from the stage. He said it, quote, "looks like the biggest human cattle market on planet Earth."
Yeah, absolutely.
And it does look a bit like that from some of the photos.
Yeah, it does. My question is, though, is this the way forward, at least in the short term, for the future of gigs? I mean, I'm pretty sure there was about 2,500 people at the show. It was outdoors. Yeah. It was huge in a massive arena.
Therein lies the problem, right there. There are only a couple of places in the world you could probably host to something like this. Like Glastonbury would be one, Coachella would be another, and maybe like Wacken Open Air in Germany. Mm-hmm. Like big areas where you can put that sort of infrastructure in and then only sell a few thousand tickets. Like that's therein lies the problem in that the concert itself has to be in a huge area, which means you need huge stage production to project yourself across an area like that. And then you need to make it financially viable to only be able to sell like a couple of thousand tickets.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure it happened at an arena in Newcastle.
Yeah.
Virgin Money Unity Arena or something.
Yeah. You know what it probably is? It's probably, given that it's England, it's probably a football stadium.
Yeah, good point.
It's probably a football. Like, that's the thing. It would have to be in either big outdoor fields or big outdoor stadiums. Like, basically, you play a stadium rock arena tour to 2,000 people every night. You know?
Apparently, this is something that has been in the works for a while as well. So, there's a regional promoter over there who's trying to bring in a whole bunch of concerts that are all going to be socially distanced, including the Libertines, Two Door Cinema Club, and Van Morrison. I don't know if it's that Van Morrison.
Is he still
around? I don't think he is.
No, he's dead.
So, you know, it's sort of an experimental concept. So at this point, I think people are probably willing to throw money at it and see whether or not it works. Now, interestingly, there was alcohol as well.
I need to just jump in here and quickly follow up something. Van Morrison is very much still alive. He's 74 years old.
Oh, okay. I thought he was a bit older than that. So maybe it is Van Morrison.
I was going to say, I thought he was dead, so...
Yeah, I thought he was...
Wrong dead. On all counts.
Well, there you go. We learned something today. You know, but I mean, it's going to be... I think it's going to be something really interesting. And then you're right. I mean, what about the cost of the actual thing? So my question is then, does it become like seating tickets? So, you know, the further you are to the front, the more you pay.
Oh, okay. Sort of like the Hyde Park show I went to see in London.
Where if
you're right up the front, you're paying... I've no idea what they paid to be up the front. And if you're a bit further back, it was like £90.
Yeah, if it's in Australia, you could do it in
Hyde Park in London.
Yeah.
Getting everybody in and out of Hyde Park in London with social distancing would be a challenge, but...
Well, I mean, you could do it here. You could do it in ANZ Arena in Sydney, right?
Yeah.
Not ANZ Stadium. Not a problem. You could very easily do that.
This particular part of the arena, everybody goes in through this door and this door only.
Exactly.
If you're in this quadrant, you go in through door A. If you're going through the other one, you're going in through door B.
That's right.
Like I said, but this is the thing. This sort of gig you could only do in big stadiums or large open air things like Glastonbury or something like that. Because if you took this down to the next level and tried to do it at like a theatre gig, I don't think you'd sell enough tickets at a price point that people are prepared to pay to get it to happen. Because that's the thing. If you've only got 2,500 people in a stadium that would normally hold 40,000 people, you have to sell tickets at some high price. And do people have the money to do that now? Yeah. Unknown.
Yeah, but it's definitely something to watch, I think.
Absolutely.
I think it's definitely something to watch.
Now, speaking of things to watch, there is a petition that I'm sure many of you out there have seen and have probably seen the article that generated the petition. There is a petition that is doing the rounds to... have Spotify pay a 1 cent per play instead of the 0.0039 cents or whatever they're paying now. This, of course, sparked from the rather divisive comments from Spotify CEO Daniel Ek.
Is that what we're going to go with? Divisive?
Yeah.
Is that the term we're going to use?
For now.
Okay, right on.
To say that if musicians want to make more money, they should just make more records. As if music records are like washing machines or iPods or something like that, stuff you can just crank out on a factory line.
Well, this is kind of what we were talking about a little bit earlier, which is going to wind up in the post show. And that is, this is one of the reasons why people are opting to do, you know, single thing instead of album. Because
it gives them more bites at the cherry.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, frankly, I think this guy is an absolute prick for suggesting that.
Would it be any surprise to you to learn that he used to be the CEO of uTorrent?
Sorry, he fucking what? One of the world's...
He was, like, the CEO of...
largest file-sharing networks. uTorrent. That uTorrent.
He was briefly the CEO of uTorrent... working with the founder, and then that ended when uTorrent was sold to BitTorrent in 2006. So, yeah. Basically, what he's done is taken effectively what uTorrent is and managed to find a way to wring a couple of pennies out for the musicians and billions for himself.
Yeah, see,
solely based upon the net worth of Spotify and nothing else.
See, this is the thing, right? I don't have any problem with people making money, and I never have. What I have an issue with is how that money is made and what they do with it afterwards if they've got some sort of a social responsibility. In this particular case, he could definitely make it a cent per play. right? With the amount of subscribers around the world that Spotify has, they could easily pay a cent or even half a cent per play. You know what I mean? Rather than 0.0004 or whatever it is at the moment. Yeah, this is going to be something that's definitely worth watching, I think. Frankly, I don't think it's going to go anywhere, but it's probably worthwhile keeping our eye on it.
It's interesting, though, because according to some numbers here, more than 750,000 songs are being streamed around the world every minute on Spotify.
Okay, so 750,000 times 30 because, no, sorry, times 20 because roughly 3 minute songs. It's 15 million.
Oh, I was thinking you were going to try and work out how many cents they were going to have to pay out in royalties every day.
Oh, that's what I'm going to be doing. So it's 15 million songs, roughly an hour, times 24, times 365 equals times 0.01. $1.314
billion. $1.3 billion to be paid out in royalties every single year. That's a quarter of what Spotify is worth. Spotify itself is worth $20 billion a year. It's net worth of $20 billion.
Yep, net worth of $20 billion. And they quarter one from this year, they made, well, total revenue is 1.848 billion euros.
So you'll be paying out pretty much all of that in royalties.
No. 1.314 billion for a year.
That's their revenue or their profit?
No. So 1.314 billion a year would be going out.
Right.
Their revenue for the first quarter of this year, just the first quarter, was 1.848 billion euros.
So they can probably afford it.
That's my point.
Whether or not they want, and if they do, let's say they do, we all know what's going to happen. They're just going to jack up the cost of the Spotify membership.
Of course,
it's not $16.99 a month now; it's like $25 a month.
Exactly.
Just jack the Spotify thing, and you know what? I reckon if they were paying 1 cent per play, I reckon people would be happy to pay $25 a month.
Absolutely, I would. I'd have no issues with it at all.
Yeah, if they were actually getting 1 cent per play.
Yep.
What that shake, and obviously, you know, if it's a flat 1 cent per play, that kind of makes it a bit better. The bigger artists who get the most plays get the most money.
Mm. What I don't understand is why they don't do it as a negative scale.
Here's the thing I don't understand. Why don't they do it like YouTube Red? Let's say it's $25 a month and you mm-hmm. only listen to five different bands.
Mm-hmm.
You split that money five ways and send it to the people. So that's the YouTube Red model.
Yep.
They take the money that you make, you watch certain people's videos, and mm-hmm. they get a percentage of that based upon the video. As far as I understand, that's how it works, unless they've changed the model since the last time I read about it.
Mm.
Why not that? It basically amounts to the same thing. The artists that have the most people listening to them get the most money.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone has a problem with that. That's how it's always worked. You sell the most records, you make the most money.
Well, yeah,
have the
exactly.
most people listening, you make the most money. What's wrong with that?
Nothing. I don't think anything is wrong with that.
Do I think this petition's going to go anywhere? Not a chance in hell.
Oh, fuck no.
Not unless they got... And the thing is as well, people are saying, oh, but if they got the record companies behind it. The record companies are the ones who directly profit from the profitability of Spotify.
Mm-hmm.
You look at who the big shareholders are in Spotify. It's the big three. The big three record companies are the biggest shareholders in Spotify. Spotify wins, they win.
Of course.
So yeah, I think we've just about reached the end of the news, though, haven't we?
I'm pretty sure that's about it. Yeah, bit of a weird ending. So I say we head on to our main topic this time around, which is Swoppers 11's album From a Distance, brand new album from these Europrog guys.
Although they have members all over the world, though. This isn't exclusively from just in Europe. There are people who are playing on this.
I mean, that's their style. I don't mean that's where they're from.
Yes, that's very much the sound.
So let's dive into this. All right.
We've spoken about the first song on this record already. We spoke about this a couple of weeks ago, The Collector.
Yes, we did.
And I said that this record, like, obviously, for those of you who didn't hear that episode, the quick backstory to this band is all of the members of this band are people who have played on stage with Marillion during their bit that they do during the fan conventions called Swap the Band. You play guitar, Steve Rothery steps off stage, you put on the guitar, and you play a song with the band.
Yep.
So all of those people have gotten together and wrote a record together. Now, unsurprisingly, because they're all big Marillion fans, the influences of Marillion on this record are going to be obvious. It's literally the reason why the band exists in the first place, and they probably had to start from somewhere. But I would have hoped they would have tried to add some different sounds in and maybe some of their own individuality. But at least from the first couple of songs, The Collector, Tomorrow, and Distance, they haven't. I could go through this and talk about all the different guitar tones and the chord changes that they have borrowed, I suppose is the nicest way to put it, from Marillion songs, but nobody wants to hear that. Those first three songs on the record, they're not terrible songs. They're very well constructed, they're very well orchestrated, but there's so much Marillion in them that I find it a bit hard to listen to. What about you, Dave?
Look, the first three tracks, I am not as big a Marillion fan as you, right? So I'm sitting there listening and I'm going, this is just kind of quintessential Europrog. And when I think about it, that's Marillion. So, you know, there is the Marillion influences there are obviously going to be quite pronounced because of how the band formed. You know, I mean, there's some parts of it where I'm getting a bit of U2 as well. I think it was the second track, Tomorrow. The lyrics kind of remind me a bit of U2. I don't know why.
No, neither do I. I don't know. Maybe it's just the directness of it. The sort of directness of the message, I think. Some of these songs, I mean, this one and the last one, Hope is a Stranger, they are sort of quite politically, or not so much political, but more like social commentary.
Yes.
There are social commentary pieces throughout these lyrics, and good on them, you know. There's a lot of crap going on in this world, and someone may as well sing about it.
Absolutely.
They're sort of in a way that's quite sort of in your face and kind of bash you over the head with it a bit, which doesn't quite float my boat. For some people, and look, I'm sure for some people this record is going to be the greatest thing in the world, and there are going to be a lot of people out there, and there are a lot of people out there, who sing the praises of this record. But as we go through this, I don't think Dave and I are going to be what those people.
No, I don't think so.
We'll get into it a bit. There is one song I did want to talk about, actually, which is Spectrum, which is the fourth song on the record.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's start there.
Yeah, let's start there, because the first three songs on this record, The Collector, Tomorrow, and Distance, are so very close to the Marillion. All I could hear through there was like, they've taken that bit from Out of This World. They've taken that bit from Hard as Love, and they've taken this other bit from The Invisible Man. And I'm just like, And there's not really much point to talk about those three songs rather than me just getting angry and just start yelling about them. So, we're going to skip past that for your sake as well as ours, because we don't need to do that here.
I think Spectrum, I do want to say there was the guitar at the start of Spectrum. I'm fairly certain that's a Maton. Maton preamps have this thing where you hear them and you go, oh, I know what that is. You know, there was a quintessential Strat tone. I mean, the Marillion
there is a lot of Strat on this record.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Steve must be very happy, either very happy about someone he's stealing his tone and solos and playing style, or probably a bit annoyed.
I suspect the latter more than the former.
Because he's pretty protective over that sort of stuff, isn't he?
Of the guitar tone that he's developed more recently, yes, very much so. The earlier stuff, you know, the guitar tone through the 80s and into the early 90s, yeah, there's a lot of Strat. There's a lot of, I think it's is it the JC120 guitar amp?
Yeah, the Roland JC Chorus, yep.
Yep, there's a lot of that on there, and, you know, And there was a conscious decision made at some point in the 90s to kind of get away from that guitar sound and make it a bit less of a cliche. But yeah, there's obviously a lot of Strat playing on this record, and there's plenty of it. And, you know, the problem is it's just so obvious. That's part of the problem, I think.
No, I agree with you.
Yeah.
I mean, the next track, New Year's Revolution, Resolution, sorry.
Yep.
It was an interesting soundscape, but it was kind of one of the more poppy songs on the album.
Yeah, there is a lot of the pop influences as well. I mean, and also as well, I mean, when we say that there's a lot of, like, looking at the Marillion sound that I closely associate with this record is very much the sort of mid to late 90s. Mm. Somewhere between Brave and probably Marillion.com. Mm. So from 94 to 99, that kind of era of Marillion. And that was the era when Steve Hogarth was in the band, and there's a lot of the sort of his pop sensibilities that sort of shaped some of those songs.
Mm.
Not to say that it was only him. I mean, the other members of the band have their various different pop influence as well. I mean, Pete Travis is a huge Beatles fan, so there's a lot of the bass line construction is kind of Beatlesque in a way. So there's definitely plenty of that. But yeah, you are right. There is some. I mean, the interesting part about Spectrum though is you've got the male vocalist and the female vocalist. So the first couple of songs it was all one vocalist doing all of the vocals, and then there's the definite change here, and it very much changes it up. And this song here is probably the reason why we're spending the most amount of time talking about it at the moment, is that it's probably the least Marillion sounding song on the record.
Yes.
Much busier drumming, different kind of guitar tones, different constructions of the guitar solos, and that addition of the female vocals. So that one's definitely my favourite on the record. The two longer songs on the record, Distance and Open Your Eyes, both of those are very, very heavily Marillion influenced. But it's really interesting with Open Your Eyes. The placement of the lyrics in the mix is odd because there's some very prescient social commentary going on about the trappings of celebrity, which I have to point out is a topic that Marillion has already done. There's lyrics, you know, Gazpacho and especially King. King is one of my favorite Marillion songs. The line about, there's a line in there which I swear Steve Hogarth is talking about Kurt Cobain. The line goes something along the lines of, "And the fire in your belly, which gave you the songs, is suddenly gone, and you feel like a fake." And I'm fairly certain that's referring to Kurt Cobain. But there's some lyrics on that just reminded me of that song so much. But, I mean, if you're going to make a statement about the trappings of celebrity and stuff, you wouldn't have thought you'd put those lyrics a bit further forward in the mix to make it a bit more prominent and that the message is being projected out there, and it just isn't.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
I mean, Open Your Eyes for me, I mean, the opening with the phone number being tapped in and such. I mean, the early 2000s called, they want their intro back.
Yeah.
You know, it was a cool opening riff. It was a nice sort of thing and a really interesting progression, but I can't help but feel I've heard it before. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like maybe Porcupine Tree or something. There's a lot of that on this album, unfortunately. There's a bit of that Stephen Wilson kind of sound in there as well.
I mean, there's a gratuitous solo, you know, which is really interesting. Maybe that brings it more into the Marillion camp. I'm not sure. But I don't want to be that guy, particularly not on a prog podcast, right? I know prog heads and we prog fans, we love long songs because they go places and their movements and so on and so forth. But this song did not have to be 13 fucking minutes.
I will agree to that.
It did not
absolutely
have to be.
Yeah.
You know,
this is a criticism that we had with the record Elders. We had that same problem as well. They were just long songs and, you know, musicals, you know, these musical middle sections in there, and just like you just feel like saying at some point, stop, come back. You know, that's enough. You can move on with the song. It doesn't need to be that long. So Yeah.
Look, moving on to the next track, First Light. I mean, nothing super special here. Except there was that sort of sound, which, I mean, I can only describe it as like a digital frog.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
I actually liked that effect. It was really cool. I'm guessing it was a synth or something like that. I thought it was kind of charming. But beyond that song itself was a bit...
Yeah, there are those sort of little synthesizer effects that are very interesting and probably take quite a bit of time to like construct, but will eventually become something that you just hit a key and it just sort of plays out as like a loop. Yeah. So, yeah, that was an interesting little song. Very interesting to place that the record after, like, a really long song like that, have a song that's only 2.5 minutes long. It's very interesting. But then we get to the final song on the record, Hope is a Stranger. Now, when I heard this song, I was struggling to place it. I'm like, I've heard this before. I've heard something like this before. And then just before we came on air, I listened through to it again, and it finally hit me. The Dream Theater song, The Killing Hand.
That's exactly what I went to when I heard it.
There's something in there. I don't know whether it's like the way the chords move in the keys or something about the melody or I don't know. There's something in there. I had The Killing Hand stuck in my mind and that was it. And I'm just like, now I understand why I keep thinking of this song in this strange way. Like, where is this coming from? What is it? But yeah.
I tend to agree with you on it. I mean, it's a bit of a meh opening, and it's a weird track, I think, in the scope of the entire album.
Yeah, this one was a little bit more metal than all of the other ones. You're absolutely right. It's very much like in that sort of Euro prog kind of sound. But this one was a bit more mid-Atlantic, I think, is probably the best way to describe it.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you with that. There's a little bit of Rush in there as well.
Not surprising if they're sort of coming from early Dream Theater. Early Dream Theater sounded a lot like Rush.
Yep, absolutely.
Especially, not so much on the later record, but especially on the first record, there was a lot of the Rush influence. You know, a lot of Hemispheres, a lot of 2112, that kind of sound on there. So not surprising that we kind of hear a bit of Rush in there as well.
Yeah, it's not particularly surprising, but I mean, it's there, and we're not doing our job if we didn't point it out.
Yeah, exactly.
We've kind of blitzed through this, right? And I think that's kind of because both of us are kind of a bit reluctant to belt this album.
Yes, exactly.
Because it's a good album. Like, there's structurally, fundamentally, there's actually nothing wrong with the album. But I think it's kind of the fact that it's basically just Marillion rehashed.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is overall, I think this album is going to have to go in the same category as the first Southern Empire record.
Yeah, okay, yep.
Like, there are people that are going to love this album, but I won't be one of them. It is the first album that the reason why I've been so reluctant to kind of bag this record is because it is the first record, and look, power to them for putting a record together in the middle of a pandemic with people from a half a dozen different countries and from 9 different countries. You know, power to them for doing it. It is the first record. We shouldn't be so surprised that the influences are going to be rather transparent. They've obviously got the musicians involved in this project clearly have some talent in writing songs and coming up with interesting lyrics and writing interesting melodies. What I'd like to see from them, though, is developing more of themselves rather than just copying from over the shoulder of Marillion.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. It is, for me, like I said, it's a Europrog album, right? But if you look at most Europrog, it's kind of got its own thing, right? So taking, obviously, Marillion, they do Marillion very, very well. Anubis from Australia, still Europrog, but their own thing. Even if you go to like Pink Floyd, arguably some of the earliest stuff.
Even some of the newer bands, even bands like Big Big Train.
Yeah, Big Train.
Again, very much rooted in that sort of Europrog sound, but they've got disparate sort of influences they take from it and pull it into. So I'd quite like to see what happens with this band, whether or not this is just a one-off project, you know, mm-hmm. okay, whatever, or if they get together and do another record at some point and try and maybe as it, maybe, and here's the thing that I'm thinking, maybe as this, as time goes on and more people do, if the entry criteria to the band, to this particular band is must perform on stage with Marillion and preferably not be in any of the actual members of Marillion's side projects, because there are a few notable absences from this record, like Martin Jakubski, for example, but he is like Steve Rothery's singer in his solo band.
Yep.
And there's another gentleman, Guy Vickers, who I have seen play keyboards at a Port Zealand convention, but he is associated with Mark Kelly's record. So absence of those two, it would be interesting to see more people who have done Swap the Band come into this band and contribute, and contributing from a different backgrounds and different styles and that sort of thing. And maybe then it'll develop itself into something more than just copying from Marillion.
No, I agree.
So don't get us wrong. We're not bagging this record. It's not a bad record. It's a record. If you like the Europrog stuff, you should listen to this album and at least have it. But fair warning, there are going to be a lot of Marillion things in there that you'll hear and you'll go, they've got that from there, or that's come from here. If you were like us and you were looking for something that is kind of new and puts a different spin on something, this record is probably not for you.
Yeah, I don't think I could put it any better. I think you've definitely summed it up for both of us in that particular way. I will add on there, though, that I want to stress it is still a good album, and particularly as a first album, it's a very good album. But I probably am not going to be running back for a second listen.
No, me either. But I'll be very interested to see what they come up with in the future. We can come back to this band a bit later on.
Absolutely. All right. So
we should move on to our album reviews.
We should move on to that. Hoggy, the one you gave me last time.
Ah, yes, The Repercussions of Angelic Behaviour by Bill Reiflin, Robert Fripp, and Trey Gunn. I'm very interested to hear what you thought of this album.
I'm going to write down exactly what I wrote down after listening to the first minute and a half of the first track. Oh, dear God, it's another psychoactive acid trip in audio form. Instrumental jazz wankery just isn't my cup of tea.
Yeah, there is a lot of that. This is probably at the most esoteric end of what King Crimson does.
Yeah. It was combining
the avant-garde jazz, free jazz, jazz fusion, whatever the hell you want to call it, sort of putting all that in a big melting pot and seeing what comes out. There's a lot of that going on. I thought you might have been interested in some of Robert Fripp's guitar tones, because I cannot work out for the love of money what the hell he's using to come up with that.
I don't know. It could be a pig nose amplifier for all I know.
His live setup does involve a barrage of pedals in front of him. He's like sitting on a stool and there's just a pedal board the size of a small television in front of him. Basically the size of a big flat screen TV in front of him, with a whole bunch of pedals on there, and he's stepping on pedals and changing this, that, and using like, you know, what would be a volume pedal to change stuff throughout the whole concert. So in answer to the question of what his guitar tone comes from, probably comes from a whole bunch of stuff. But as far as I can work out, he's never discussed it publicly.
Yeah, well, probably hasn't.
Another guitarist that is incredibly protective of their guitar tone.
I will admit, though, I'd probably listen to Strangers on a Train again, but it'd probably have to be in the context of a soundtrack to a movie. I actually didn't mind that track. That one was okay, but the vast majority of the rest of it was just, it's kind of a bit jumbly
A little bit too esoteric for your tastes, what you're saying.
Yes, just a touch. I could appreciate it. Don't get me wrong. I appreciated what was going on, but it left me a bit cold.
Fair enough. Now, the record that you gave to me, is a band that we put out an interview for last week, Frogs yes. the Golden Path. Yes. I actually rather enjoyed this album. Now, I have no idea what all of the art history things come to. I did not take art history at university and took a major that probably was like diametrically opposed to that. So I'm sure there's some very interesting things going on lyrically in there for the people who understand art and understand the art history. Musically as well, I thought it was very interesting. There are definitely the mix of like prog and a sort of a, I don't know where it comes from. They mentioned Linkin Park in the interview, didn't they?
Well, I did.
Help me out here, though.
But yes, through that, yeah, absolutely.
There's definitely
some really interesting influences for them.
Absolutely, and I am very interested to see what comes forth from them in the future. I really want to see where this band. What if they are going to be doing more sort of art history concept type albums? That's very interesting, and I'd be very interested to see what they come up with next.
Me too. I am really keen to see where they go next. What their next trick is going to be. Because if they keep doing what they're doing now, it's pretty unique by comparison to everything else that's around.
Absolutely. I feel like this band is sort of like a little bit of akin to Thematic, in that I kind of feel like we've kind of discovered these guys and they're doing really interesting stuff. And well, when I say we, it's the royal we, and it's all you, Dave, but
no, we is fine.
Yes. So, a very interesting record. Give it a big thumbs up. Have a listen to that record.
So now what have you got for me next week? That's what I want to know.
Now, following up from the interview that you did with Dakota talking about Ebon Ivory, I checked out one of the bands that she suggested. This band comes out of Bendigo in Victoria called Ironstone. Now, they put a record out a couple of months ago called Prophecy. I want you to have a listen to that record and tell me what you think.
Okay, no problems. Will do. For you, I've got a brand new prog album that was only released a couple of days ago at time of recording. This is a band called Telegy, and their album is called Black Swallow. That's all I'm going to say. Have a listen to it. Awesome.
Alrighty.
Well, that about brings us to the end of the episode. Thank you so much for listening in and tuning in to us. Remember, if you do want some more bonus content and early access to things, you can always join our Patreon page. It's about $3 a month, and it just goes a little bit of the way to help us keep this show on the air.
Absolutely.
Next time on the show, what have we got?
We are going to be going track by track on a record that we're actually very excited to review. Glass Ocean's The Remnants of Losing Yourself in Someone Else.
Yes. It's
going to
be
looking
fantastic.
Forward to listening to this album for quite some time. And the little singles and little snippets that we've heard of this record already. It sounds like a very interesting one. And so we are going to go track by track on that. I'm fairly certain we're going to like it a hell of a lot more than we probably did from Swappers 11.
I would suggest so. The next couple of interviews that we've got coming up too, as we mentioned, we've got Maiora, who will be joining us on the show the next couple of weeks in time. We've also got a young bloke. I say a young bloke. I actually don't know exactly how old the guy is. Called Sahil Makija. I'm so sorry if I'm butchering your name there, Sahil. Some of you who are into food and fitness and things like that might know him as the host of Headbangers Kitchen, which is a keto cooking show online. He's from India, and it's really, really cool. He is actually a metal musician by himself, hence the name. And I've been following his recipes for a little bit, hence started doing this low carb thing that I'm doing. His recipes are fantastic, and I wanted to find out exactly what the metal scene was like in India. So he's going to be joining us on the show as well, sometime over the next few weeks. And of course, the big one, next week, I will be interviewing Mr. John Petrucci, who will be joining us on the show to talk all things about his brand new album, Terminal Velocity, as well as other stuff that we want to chat about, whether that be his getting swole weightlifting regime or his bourbon collection or his smoking meats or anything else which we may want to chat about at that time. And of course, if you're a Patreon user, you guys get first in on that, on any interviews actually that we do. So you guys get to hear them before anybody else. So if you do have a few bucks to throw at us, that'd be absolutely awesome. And it is definitely worth your while.
So that wraps it up here on the 9-8 podcast. If you'd like to find the links to the show notes for this episode, you can find them at the 9-8podcast.fireside.fm/59. You can find us on Twitter at 9-8fm. And if you wish to send us an email with any questions or queries or feedback for the show, you can find a link at the 9-8podcast.fireside.fm/contact. And we do read all the feedback that comes in. If you've got anything that you want to tell us, by all means, send it in.
Absolutely. Until next time, my name's Dave Ellis.
And my name is Alex Hogg. See you next time.
See you then. Stay safe.